3, but I want to bring out one or two things from chapter 2, which I've just had a look at this afternoon. Joshua is in a very particular situation. We'll just kind of put ourselves in mind of what's been going on and then seek to sort of derive some lessons from it as well. But the first thing is that Joshua is certainly a man of faith, isn't he? He's a man of faith. And right in the beginning of chapter 2 in verse 1, the sending out of the spies is a step of faith. This is something that Moses did. It went badly wrong, but he's doing the same thing, knowing and praying that this time the outcome will be different. Mistakes happen in the past. Things don't work out always as we hope. And we can be intimidated and get to thinking that we can't continue to do those things, even if they're good things, because next time we may also experience some kind of failure. So there's an act of faith here, isn't there, as he sends out the spies. Do you remember how on the ark, Noah, he sent out the birds? Do you remember that? To find out if the land was dry and the bird went out and it came back. There wasn't a positive response. He did it again. There wasn't a positive response. But he didn't give up, did he? He didn't give up. And eventually the bird came back with a little olive branch in its mouth, and the time of peace came and they were able to open the ark and go out. In the same way, Joshua is sort of sending out that envoy, doesn't know whether this will bring a good report or a bad report, but he hears this by the end, this good report comes. And it's a wonderful thing, isn't it, when something you get involved in doesn't work out perhaps as you hope. We invest ourselves into things. We're easily bruised, we're easily discouraged by situations, and consequently we become averse to the risks. We are less likely to put our faith out there and invest our hearts into situations. We become perhaps reticent and a bit cold. Our faith may be weakened by experiences, but there is only one resolution to this, and that is really the resolution that Joshua employs, which is to try again, to find faith and courage, just to have another go. And that's what he does. And by the end of the passage in chapter 2, at the end of verse 24, he gets this positive response. Things don't always work out the same way every time, do they? And as you know it's God and you persist with something that was right, even though it may be difficult, eventually Joshua gets this good response back, and it's a great encouragement to him and to the people of Israel. And something happens in the midst as well, because the first set of envoys, as they went into the land, they kept themselves very much to themselves. But these spies in chapter 2, they went in and they met people. They met this woman Rahab, didn't they? They had this encounter, this engagement with the people of the land. And one of the things that people say about the book of Joshua is about the vicious nature of the war that we're going to read about over the next few chapters, the way the Israelite army went into the land and fought this very uncompromising conflict against the inhabitants of the land. But you can see in chapter 2 that anybody who wanted peace could have peace. Here was somebody who wanted peace, somebody who didn't want to engage in a conflict, somebody who recognized that God was with Israel and was willing to accept Israel's God. And for that person, the offer of peace was there. So I think that should at least make us aware that peace was always an option. Peace was always a possibility. And it must have been as nerve-wracking for Rahab as she let the spies go and said goodbye to them, and all she had was a word from them. She just had this one word that when they came back, they would be saved. They wouldn't perish, they would live. And it must have been very nerve-wracking when you've just got a word. You've just got a promise from someone that everything's going to be all right. It's just a word. And a terrible judgment is coming. A terrible and hard day is going to befall the land. And all you've got is just a promise. And that's something that perhaps we experience as Christians, isn't it? Perhaps we get to doubting God's word. We only just have a word and a promise that everything will be all right, that we will be saved, that we will be safe. And even though everything we know is just going to go crazy all around us, that we're just hanging on to those promises. And so the spies go in and they give this undertaking, this promise of salvation to this one individual. And really, anybody who calls on the name of the Lord will be saved. That's the offer we're able to make, isn't it? As we go out into the world, we can tell people, if you call upon the name of the Lord, you'll be saved. We can give that undertaking to people, can't we? We can make that promise to people. We have been empowered and licensed as God's people to go out into the world, to encounter people, to meet with people and tell them about the coming judgment, tell them about the things that are still to come, but give them this promise that if they put their trust in Christ, they shall be saved. If they'll call upon the name of the Lord, they'll be safe. And those of you who are here today, you've put your trust in Christ, you're holding on to that kind of a promise, and you haven't seen the promise fulfilled yet. You haven't seen Christ return. You haven't seen the final judgment worked out. And the world does go crazy around us at times, doesn't it? Things happen, and it shakes you sometimes even to the core. The whole life seems to get turned upside down by different things that happen in the world. But you've got this promise from God. And we see that as we go into the chapter 4 later, that the way that they fulfill the promise, they do fulfill the promise to Rahab in the coming chapters. And she is saved. But if the spies hadn't gone in and met with her, they would have never been able to give her that assurance. So these were good men, and they went in and they brought a good report, and they did good wherever they went. And that's something to remember. But there's a lot of people there in the city of Jericho who did not want to hear, who weren't willing and ready, it seems, to hear about the good news. They were hunting these people down. They were opposed and hostile to these messengers. And so they had to hide and retreat and return. And that's where we pick it up in chapter 3. And we see that the message comes back, and once again, there's always that possibility, this nervousness, I suppose, amongst the many, many people there. The word comes back, it's a positive report, it's time to move, it's time to go. That will the people back down the way they did before? People like to back away, don't they? It's amazing sometimes you make an offer to somebody and they say, yes, I'll do it. They give you their word, they give you an undertaking. But when the moment comes, they back away, they back down. They let you down. That does happen in life. But here, once again, though that had happened in Moses' experience, people he trusted, people he looked to, people who were there to help him, turned in difficult times under pressure. But here in this situation, we don't see that. Again, you know, we should never be discouraged. Even though sometimes situations don't work out the way we want them to, sometimes we get setbacks and hardships we face in the Christian life. Don't give up. Don't give up. Don't give up on your faith. Don't give up on your obedience. Here, the people rally, don't they? The people rally behind Joshua. They're ready to do what he says. They're ready to cross the River Jordan. And what stands before them in verse 1, Joshua rose early in the morning, and then they came to the Jordan. Do you see? They came to the Jordan. You all know the Jordan is a river, isn't it? It's a river. It's a very, very hot country. Those of you who know that part of the world in any way, it's a very hot country. And in the summer months, it's so hot, really, the river is not much of a river. It's quite a small river. You can kind of, you know, it's probably about no wider than this room. You could probably just wade across the river. It's not a significant river. In fact, we know about Jesus and John the Baptist and people. They went down there and they baptized in the river. They just waded out into the river. It wasn't a big deal, and they got baptized out there in the river. It's not a huge river like some of the other great rivers that you find in the Bible. But this river, the River Jordan, we read about a little bit later on in verse 15. It says it's during the harvest time, and there are two harvests in the Israelite calendar, and this is the first harvest, the spring harvest. And in the spring harvest, what's happened is the river runs north through the Lake Galilee, and then beyond that, the river goes further up into the mountains. It goes up into the Alps. They have Alps in the Lebanon, and that's why in Syria you can go, when there's not a war on, you can go skiing in Syria. You can go skiing in the Lebanon. You can go skiing in Israel. There's a perpetual kind of snow-capped mountains in the north there. But over the winter months, obviously, a lot of snow falls. And when the spring comes and the sun begins to shine, you know what happens. The snow begins to melt, and the waters just start to rush down the mountains, and they rush down into the Jordan, they flood into the Galilee, and they overflow into the Jordan River, and the Jordan spreads its banks, and there's a very wide floodplain. A floodplain, possibly. And so what we have here is that they arrive at the Jordan River at the time, you could argue, at the worst possible time. at the time which is most off-putting, the time when it seems least likely to be successful, the time when the things that stand before them look most difficult to face. The river is wide, the river is deep, the river is fierce. This is not a good season for crossing the River Jordan. And that, I think, comes out from the passage here. And this situation is a situation that from chapter 2 and chapter 3 is being viewed from two different vantage points. If we were making a film, we'd have a camera inside Jericho looking eastward towards the Jordan River, and we would have a camera amongst the Israelites on the other side of the river looking at the river, looking westward, and they're both looking at the river from their different vantage points and from their different perspectives. Like most situations, it depends how you look at it. It's the same situation, but you can look at it from different points of view, can't you? And there's this great big raging torrent of a river standing between Israel on the one hand and the people of Jericho on the other hand. And oftentimes we have these situations, and depending on where you stand, you feel or look differently at this river in its flood. Now, I think if you're a citizen of Jericho, you look at the river and the flood in its flood, and to you, this is a great wall of defense. This is a great comfort to you. You see this great raging river, and you think, I've got my city, and I've got my walls, I've got my God, I've got my way of life, I've got my soldiers, I've got my security, I've got my familiarity, I've got everything around me, the things that I like, and this is a good season. This is a secure season. The river's in flood. This is the best possible defense that I could ask for at any given time. And if this was a time when Israel was going to try and make trouble for us, even though I can see that there are thousands and thousands of Israelites on the far side of the river, you might be inclined to kind of stand on the battlements and go, you know, no, you can't touch me, or something like that. Or take a kind of an attitude where you feel pretty good, you feel pretty secure. So I think if you're standing on the Jericho side of the river, though you might be deeply, deeply troubled by the news you've heard of the things that have happened amongst the Israelites, the miracles that they've experienced, the incredible things that God did down in Egypt, though those stories may have come, you might be somewhere deep down, you may be have this sense of impending judgment and doom. But you can quieten those thoughts down. You can keep those things quiet because the river is in full flood. And you can say just, well, I've heard the stories. I've heard the things about God. I've heard about this God. But the river's in full flood. This is a good season and I'm secure. People can take an attitude like that. I'm in possession of the land. I've got peace. And I am enjoying this kind of this position on my side of the river. And people get like that, don't they? They get very comfortable. They feel very secure in themselves. And that's one way of looking at the river. And let's switch cameras now. Camera 2 comes on. And now we're looking at the river from the other side of the river. You know, Jericho side of the river is green and lush. There's palm groves and the slopes going up onto the hillside. It's a good land flowing with milk and honey and all those sort of things, isn't it? And then if you're on the other side of the river, all those things are on the other side, aren't they? The peace you want, the security you want, the fulfillment, the sense of fulfillment you want, and opportunities that you want, all those things are just out of reach. You can see them, but it seems that you can't have them. To you, that river represents everything that's stopping you from laying hold of the things that you care about the most, the even things that you believe God would give you, that God wants you to enjoy and to know. And yet you're constantly being boxed in and vexed by the presence of this river in flood. And every time you think, I'd love to have that, I'd love to do that, I'd love to be there, there's this great big river holding you back, penning you into the wilderness, and seemingly condemning you to just going around and around, repeating the same old patterns that you've been doing for so, so long. and you'd love to see a change. You'd love to see your life get better. You'd love to see more of God in your life, but the river says, this is not the season. This is not the season. You know, we know from chapter 2 and verse 10, let's just imagine they had something called a church meeting in Jericho. Now, I don't believe they actually had church meetings in Jericho, okay? I know I'm eccentric, but I'm not that eccentric, okay? But let's imagine that the city people were gathering together and had conversations amongst themselves about the situation. The Israelites are coming. They know that they're coming. And they have this feeling of security about their river, which has always protected them and always helped them at this time of the year. And we get a little insight because Rahab is spilling the beans on what's been going on inside Jericho. She's leaked the minutes from the meeting. She's telling all, isn't she? Because she's confessing that at bottom line, they are rattled. The people are rattled. We have heard how the Lord dried up the waters of the Red Sea before you when you came out of Egypt, and what you did to the two kings of the Amorites who are beyond the Jordan, Zion and Og, who you devoted to destruction. And as soon as we heard it, our hearts melted, and there was no spirit left in any man because of you. For the Lord your God, he is the God of the heavens above and the earth beneath. The God of the heavens above and on the earth beneath. They know that even though they may feel secure, they have got a problem. They know there's something brewing. So that's their kind of, whereas you can imagine on the other side of the river, the Israelites are hearing this report. And we know that they received the report gladly. And we know they were obedient because we've read about it in chapter 2, verse 24. They hear the report, and chapter 3 onwards, they move and they start to move forward. But they must at the same time, come on, let's have enough human compassion to understand that they must have approached that river with some trepidation, some feeling of dread. Do you know there's a difference between walking in faith, believing? Didn't somebody say courage is not the absence of fear, but it is the mastery of our fears? You know, it's courageous, isn't it, to walk towards that river? It may think this looks foolish. This is crazy. You're going to drown. You'll never make it. You're going to fail. Have you ever heard, you know, unsettling kind of thoughts? You ever have unsettling voices? They go, they're moving towards it, and the only thing to remedy their hearts and remedy their mind as they approach the impossible, to doing the impossible, is not looking at the river, but looking at their God. The God who opened the river, the Red Sea, and praying that the same God who opened that water will open this water for them. That the God who did great things for our forebears in the past times will be the God, not that we're just going to read about and celebrate the past things that God did, that God would act for us. That he'd be our God. That he'd save us even as he saved people in the past. So same river, two points of view. And one thing is that whatever those feelings are, what anybody put too much store on the capacity of that river in its full flood, their views were going to change radically in the next period of time. Because everything on earth is subject to change. Nothing is stable. Only God. Only God. And what we read about in verse 15 is this extraordinary event. It is an extraordinary event. As the priest dipped their feet in the brink of the water, that's the little shallow bit right on the far side of the bank, something extraordinary happened. And I'm not going to stand here and try and explain it. But all I'm telling you is that this is a faithful record of those events. The waters piled up. In the same kind of language that we read about what God did for the same people in the previous generation as they arrived at the Red Sea. And they discovered, didn't they, the God of them is our God. The God who did that for them is the God who will do that for you. The God who saved them is the God who will save you. And as those waters opened up, the God with whom all things are possible, against all the circumstances that speak to the contrary, that God acts in history. And whether it's for the people of Israel as they cross, that sense of hope and future victories fills their hearts. But for Rahab, looking back from Jericho, looking out of her window at Jericho, her salvation is coming. That sense of hope and future. And for those who did not believe, the waters opening up, that is a moment of terror and dread at the appearance of the coming judgment. So, that's my first point. With God, everything is possible. With God, everything is possible. That just because we've had bad experiences or we're facing difficult things does not mean that God is not able to do exceedingly abundantly above and beyond all we could ask or all we can think. Now, looking at this passage, I'm sure you recognize that there's quite a number of familiar things, that the experiences they're having are quite similar to the experiences that people had had in the previous generation. There's a lot of familiar language between the two passages, both in the time of Moses and now in the time of Joshua. Previously, it was the Red Sea. Now, it's the Jordan River. In one sense, there's a replay taking place. The same events are being played out, but for different people in different generations. And I think there are patterns. There are patterns of salvation. The things that you can see a trajectory, if you draw a line from that to this and going forward to this and to that, that God is the same God acting throughout history. He hasn't changed. Egypt, they must have had a trust in the Red Sea to box Israel in, just as much as the people of Jericho must have had trust that the river would box Israel in. They say, this isn't possible, you're never going to make it. And they were wrong. And Israel must have been afraid when it came to the Red Sea, just as much as they were afraid when they came to the Jordan. But as it turns out, those fears were wrong and misplaced. Because in the end, God has the last word. God is God, and there is no other. The truth is, I don't know what rivers stand before you, but I know that God is the God who is greater than the rivers. He made the rivers and the sea. That's pretty presumably one of the great messages of Genesis chapter 1, that all these things that people put their trust in, they're like idols. They become like idols to people. People worship. But in the end, there's only one God, and he made all these things. So trust him. People overestimate things, don't they? We see people putting too much trust in things. They put too much trust in money, or they put too much trust in their education, or they put too much trust in their family and its connections, perhaps. They put too much trust in the past. They think the past has such influence, so much influence. They think perhaps their present situation has all this influence. They overestimate these things. It's easy to do. And it's also easy to underestimate God in the situation, underestimate God's work in the world. To do more than money could do, to do more than education could do, to do more than family and its connections, to overcome your past, to overcome your situation, to go before you and help you in this life. People underestimate God. It's so helpful, isn't it, to have a right view of God and to have a right view of the things and the situations we face. They're real, but God is. But God is. And here in these two chapters, we see that, in fact, Joshua and Rahab have a lot in common. They agree, don't they? And you find people on both sides of the rivers who actually come to agree. They come to see the situations in the right perspective. They realize that a river is not the final word, that the answer is with God, that he is a truly great God. And that's the body of faith, isn't it? All sorts of different people from different walks of life and different life experiences coming together, growing closer, getting to understand each other, sharing a common salvation by the same God. And there are these other people in these episodes too who seemingly are unable to see what's about to happen. They overestimate things. They underestimate God. Do you remember the great rebuke that Jesus said? He was talking to his opponents. He said, "You're so good. You can tell the weather. You can tell what the weather forecast is, can't you? You're good at making a weather forecast. How come you can't see what God is doing?" I'm paraphrasing. How come you can't see the trajectory of history? Can't you see the way that all this thing is going? Can't you see that in the end, God has the final word? God is the God of what was. He's the God of what is. And he is the God of what will be. And the river may be in flood, like we read in chapter 3, verse 15. But God is greater than the flood. God is greater than the flood. And that's really my second point, is that God, with God all things are possible. And the good news, God is. God is. So lastly, there's also a kind of a word of caution in chapter 3. A word of caution in chapter 3. You see from verse 4 there, this instruction that the people should give a distance between themselves and the Ark of the Covenant as it goes forwards. You see, the trouble is that we can get complacent, we can get cozy with God, if I can put it like that. We can come to a state of mind where we forget that for Moses approaching the Red Sea, it was a new situation and required real faith. And for Joshua facing the river, it was a new situation for them. And that's the thrust of this, isn't it? I'm leading you in a way that you have not gone before, there at the end of verse 4. That for Joshua, although he knew what had happened in the past, he was being warned not to assume how God would work it out in his time. That he should stand back and not just assume that because God did it like that then, that he's going to do it like that this time. God will do it, but stand back and see what God will do. Don't assume, don't presume on the living God. Stand back, give room. You see, it's glib, isn't it, to say that as a person is approaching their river, as they're approaching their difficulties, say, "Oh, it'll be all right. You know, it was okay for Moses. It was okay for Joshua. It'll be okay for you. It's not going to be, God's done it before. He'll do it again." It's a real test. It's a real trial. It's a real experience. This is real life. And this is the working of our real God. You see, if a test is not a test, if it's not testing you, then it's not a test. If a trial isn't actually trying you, it's not a trial. And these times, these situations are real tests and trials, aren't they? That river before them was a real test, a real trial, a real temptation to believe something other than the truth. And we should never be glib about the reality of temptations and tests and trials and think, "Oh, yeah, temptations, tests and trials, they get passed by God's people in the past. Oh, they're real." If you're not genuinely tempted, really, truly tempted, it's not a temptation, is it? And these experiences that God's people have had in the past, the experiences we have now, the experiences of the God's people in the future, they're real. And idols present themselves to us, like this river ultimately is an idol, isn't it? The idol that says you can't, as if it has the final word and the final authority. Idols present themselves to us for our worship. They want our worship. And people do give worship to idols, don't they? Isn't the whole history of Israel, time and time again, worshiping the things rather than worshiping the maker of these things? So don't think and get so complacent that we would be above temptation or above tests or above trials. Moses had his Red Sea. Joshua has his river. We have our rivers, and the rivers flood.
they flood.
So let's not be cozy. Let's not be complacent. The scriptures tell us, don't they? Familiarity breeds. So step back from God. See him. Perceive him, his greatness, his power, his sovereignty, his glory. Observe the living God and see what he will do. Don't presume upon the Lord. And there we see it in verse 4. Stand back. Stand back and see what the Lord will do. But the promise is there, isn't it? The promise is there that I will be with you. It's there in verse 7. I will begin to exalt you in the sight of all Israel. God has been with Moses, he tells Joshua. I've been with Moses and I'll be with you. Can we take that promise as we feel afraid in the approach to our rivers? That the God who was with Moses and Joshua will be with you also. Do you feel great? Maybe not. But have you got the promise? Have you got his word? Like Rahab had that word. Are you hanging on to the word, to the promises of God? And God is going to magnify himself through their lives, isn't he? Verse 7. Verse 7 there, it says, I will begin to exalt you in the sight of all Israel. In another translation, I will magnify you. You're going to look bigger. You see, as you trust God, and as you enjoy the successes that come your way as you trust God, because I trust you've all got a testimony, you've all seen God working in your lives, you can all look back and say, God did this for me. And they would come to look back on the crossing of the river and look back on it and say, well, God did that for me. God did that. That you will be perceived by others as the victorious people, the people of testimony, the people who've seen God at work, a people of faith. Maybe you've had somebody say to you something like this, I wish I had your faith. And there's a little temptation there at that moment to think, oh, man of faith. I'm a woman of faith. I'm magnified. People look up to you, or they respect you, or they esteem you, or they think, oh, look, here's this great person of faith. We've got to be so, so careful. Because it's not us that's doing it, is it? It's not us that opens the sea. It's not us that opens the rivers. It's not us that makes the way when there is no other way. It's God that does it, isn't it? So we've got to be careful that we don't even make an idol out of our faith. I have faith. I'm saved by faith. As if my faith was the thing that is getting me through and helping me through life. It's not our faith. It's the God in whom we have faith that does it. That's the important thing, isn't it? Always give God glory. Always give him the glory for that which he is due. What's the secret of us passing through on dry land? Is it our faith or is it our God? Let's make sure people know it's God who saves. It's God who saves. Just a little aside, I'm indulging myself. Probably I'm concluding. Verse 16, do you notice the name of the little town? The rivers all piled up, didn't they? The rivers piled up further back up the river there by a little town called Adam. I'm not going to go there. Okay, I'm not going to go there. But somehow it's like man saw these things. Human beings saw this thing. They saw the salvation of God. They see the victories of God's people. And it's so important that they don't say, what a great people. But they learn to say, what a great God. What a great God. Christ, the great second Adam, he has made us more than conquerors, hasn't he? More than conquerors. We didn't go to Calvary. We didn't die on the cross. We weren't laid in the tomb. We didn't rise victorious from it 3 days later. We haven't risen and ascended into heaven. We're not sitting at God's right hand interceding
for all God's people. We haven't shed our blood on the mercy seat and obtained atonement. We haven't done any of these things. It's God. Salvation is of the Lord. So the be strong and very courageous comes to us. It's be strong in the Lord and in the power of his might, in the power of his might. So important, isn't it, that we kind of like come away with a real respect for God, a real understanding of his own sovereign work of salvation in different people's lives and different situations, trusting him, but watching him, observing him, following him closely, and not presuming on his greatness and goodness. Let's just sing something together to close. Thank you, Rachel, for choosing hymns.